All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going deep into a case. It's called United States v. Donald E. Jacobs. Really fascinating case, and I think it holds a lot of really great information, especially for law students like yourselves when thinking about the world of finance and criminal justice.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the Jacobs case, it's a wild one.
It really is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking about you know, the debt elimination program, and basically it's a scheme where this guy is selling these fake certified drafts.
Yeah.
Basically saying that they can erase people's debt, and yeah, I mean, it's pretty wild stuff.
It's almost too crazy to believe.
Yeah.
So in this deep dive, we want to kind of unpack this and look at what are the key legal arguments that are in this case? What are some of the big takeaways that we can get from this case? And specifically, think about these principles that kind of extend beyond just this case. Okay, let's start with the DEP, the Debt Elimination Program. How did it work? What was the core deception going on here?
Yeah. So, I mean, at its core, you know, Jacobs and his associates were selling these bogus drafts, you know, these certified drafts to individuals who had debt, right?
Yeah.
And so basically they were saying, hey, if you pay us, you know, 15% of your outstanding debt, we're going to give you this draft that will eliminate the rest of your debt.
Wow.
Of course, these drafts were completely worthless. They had no financial backing whatsoever.
So people are paying real money for basically worthless pieces of paper.
Yeah, basically.
Okay. And what was Jacob's specific role? Was he the mastermind behind this, or, you know, what was he doing?
I mean, he was a central figure in this whole scheme. You know, he hosted seminars to promote the DEP. You know, he presented himself as an authority figure, you know, explaining how the program worked. He was also involved in the practical side of things. He processed requests for these drafts, you know. And here's the thing. You know, he obtained these fake identification documents in Mexico. And I think that really suggests that he knew that what he was doing was illegal.
Right, right. You don't get fake ODs in Mexico unless you're doing something shady.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, so at some point, I mean, this can't go on forever, right?
Right.
Did he ever get any warnings, or did anything come up that should have maybe been a red flag for him?
Yeah. So in November of 1987, he actually learned from a customer that the FBI was investigating these drafts.
Oh, wow.
And even more telling, he admitted to another customer that the drafts were worthless.
Really?
Yeah. And despite knowing all of this, he continued to process requests for these drafts.
Wow. Okay. So he knows the FBI is on his tail. He's right. Admitting to people that this stuff is fake.
Right.
And he just keeps going. Okay. So that really sets the stage for the legal battles, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of these legal issues. And I think this is really where we start to get some really valuable insights for law students about the law. So first up, attorney-client privilege.
Yeah.
This is a cornerstone of our legal system. Can you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. So attorney-client privilege is the principle that communications between a lawyer and their client are confidential, right?
Right.
It's designed to foster this really open communication so that clients feel comfortable telling their lawyer everything, which in turn allows the lawyer to provide effective representation.
Right.
But the thing is, it's not absolute.
Okay.
There are exceptions, and the crime fraud exception is really important here. And this is the one that came up in Jacobs.
Okay. So in Jacobs, certain letters between Jacobs and his attorney were actually admitted as evidence in the case. So why weren't those communications protected by attorney-client privilege?
So the court said that those letters could be admitted as evidence because they found probable cause, that's the standard, that the crime fraud exception applied.
Okay.
Now, this exception kicks in when the communication itself is used to further a crime or fraud. And the court decided that Jacobs was likely already involved in the fraud and the DEP fraud before he even talked to his attorney.
Okay.
And even worse, he misrepresented his attorney's advice to make it seem like the DEP was legitimate.
Oh, so he's basically trying to use his lawyer to like cover up his scam.
Right. Exactly. He's not actually seeking legal advice. He's trying to like weaponize it.
Right. Okay, so that makes sense. Can we maybe think of another example to kind of illustrate this?
Yeah. So imagine a client comes to you and says, hey, I need to figure out how to hide all this money I made from selling drugs.
Okay.
That communication is not going to be protected by attorney-client privilege, right?
Right.
Because it's directly related to a crime.
Got it.
And that's kind of what happened in Jacobs.
Okay, that's helpful. Okay, so let's move on to the actual bank fraud charges.
Okay.
Now, Jacobs argued that the banks didn't face any real risk of losing money. What did the court say about that?
So the court didn't buy that argument.
Okay.
They said that even a small or remote risk of loss is enough to trigger bank fraud charges.
A remote risk.
Yeah, so that's something important to keep in mind, right? You don't need to prove actual loss. The potential for loss is enough.
Interesting. Okay. And what's the reasoning behind that, that even a remote risk is enough?
Well, it all comes down to intent. The court said that the whole point of the DEP was to trick banks into getting rid of valid debts based on these worthless drafts. So even if a bank figured out the fraud and didn't honor the draft, the intent to defraud was still there.
Right. Okay.
And the court recognized that by submitting these drafts, there's always a chance that the bank might actually fall for it, even if it's just temporarily, right?
So the court was basically saying, look, it doesn't matter if the banks actually lost money.
Right.
It's the fact that Jacobs was trying to deceive them that's the problem.
Exactly.
Okay. I get it. Okay. So now let's talk about this concept of conscious avoidance.
Okay.
It sounds kind of like willful blindness.
Right.
What does that mean legally?
Mm-hmm.
And why did the judge bring this up in Jacob's trial?
Yeah. So conscious avoidance is basically when someone deliberately chooses to ignore something illegal that's happening, even though they have a pretty good idea that it's going on.
Right.
And the reason the judge instructed the jury on this is because there's evidence that Jacobs might have intentionally avoided finding out for sure that the DEP was fraudulent.
Okay. And what kind of evidence are we talking about? What are some of the red flags?
Well, like we talked about before, he got that tip that the FBI was investigating. That's a pretty big red flag, right?
Yeah.
And then there's the whole fake ID thing in Mexico. Oh. That seems like he knew something was up. And even though he told one person the drafts were worthless, he just kept running the scheme. So it seems like he really didn't want to know for sure that it was a fraud.
So he suspected it was a fraud, but just didn't want to confirm it.
Yeah, pretty much.
Interesting. Okay. So how is that different legally from actually knowing something is illegal?
Well, actual knowledge is pretty simple, right? You know what you're doing is wrong. Conscious avoidance is about deliberately trying to avoid that knowledge.
Okay.
Like sticking your head in the sand.
Right, right.
And the law sometimes treats that as the same as actual knowledge.
Wow.
Depends on the circumstances, but yeah.
So ignorance is not always bliss.
Definitely not.
Okay, so lastly, let's talk about sentencing. Jacob's got a pretty stiff sentence.
Yeah.
How did they figure that out? And can you explain this concept of intended loss? I think that's a really key thing for law students to understand.
Yeah, definitely. So they used the U.S. sentencing guidelines to figure out his sentence. And those guidelines take a lot of things into account, including how much money was involved. And in fraud cases, they often focus on the intended loss, which is how much the defendant was trying to steal, even if they didn't actually get away with that full amount.
Okay. So even if the banks didn't actually lose all the money that Jacobs was trying to take, they still considered that full amount when they were figuring out his sentence.
Right. Because the idea is that his culpability, his blameworthiness, is based on what he was trying to do, what his goal was. So in Jacobs' case, the intended loss was the total value of all those fake drafts he sold.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's not just about the actual harm, but the potential harm he was trying to cause.
Exactly.
Okay, so can you give us an example, like an analogy, to really understand this intended loss thing?
Sure. Let's say there's a bank robbery, right?
Okay.
But the robbers get caught before they can grab any cash.
Right.
They didn't actually steal anything, but they're still going to get in a lot of trouble, right?
Right.
And their sentence is going to be based on how much money they were trying to steal.
Oh, I see. So it's the same idea with Jacobs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even if he didn't actually defraud the banks of millions of dollars, his sentence reflected the fact that he was trying to do just that.
Okay, that makes sense. So big takeaway here is that intent matters a lot in these kinds of cases.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground today. For our listeners who are future lawyers, what are some of the key takeaways from the Jacobs case?
I think there are three main things to remember. First, bank fraud is a really broad statute.
Okay.
Anything that even creates a risk to a bank can get you in serious legal trouble. Second, attorney-client privilege isn't a free pass.
Right.
Especially if you're using your lawyer to help you commit a crime.
Okay.
And third, intent is huge in these white-collar crime cases.
Right.
It affects whether you're found guilty and how harsh your sentence will be. Really, really important stuff. Okay, so to wrap things up, We're taking a deep dive into United States v. Donald E. Jacobs, and we've seen how this case sheds light on some really important areas of the law. Bank fraud, attorney-client privilege, and sentencing in financial crimes.
And as you continue your legal studies, I want you to think about how these concepts, like the crime-fraud exception or intended loss, might apply in today's world, especially with all the new financial schemes and technologies out there.
Definitely. You know, the DEP might seem like something from the past, but the legal issues are still relevant today.
For sure.
Well, that's all the time we have for today.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And we'll see you next time.
See you later.